Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump earlier this month called for cutting off internet access to extremists after a bomb exploded in London. Three academics recently penned a paper on what would and wouldn't work with such a strategy. The report was published in The Conversation. We have a link to the article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. One of the authors joins us now. Thomas Holt is an associate professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You wrote that one of the oldest far-right group forums, Stormfront, has been online in some form since the early 1990s. What do we know about the impact of the internet and social media on terrorist and hate groups?
It's been a fantastic resource for them because it enables their messaging to go out to anyone, anywhere, unfiltered. So that means it doesn't have to go through traditional news media. It doesn't have any kind of spin put on it aside from what they want. And by extension, that enables recruitment and messaging to reach people no matter where they are, whether you're in Europe, whether you're in Africa. And that has a great ability for recruitment, particularly if we're talking about an extremist group that may only appeal to a very small proportion of people.
Is this something that anti-terrorism agencies, anti-hate groups, entities that are looking for them, have they been tapped into this as well since the 90s?
Yes. In fact, the Southern Poverty Law Center has been tracking the online behavior of hate groups for quite a long time.
Can you kick someone off the internet like the president suggests?
No, there's really no way to do that. The internet is a resource, and you can utilize virtually any kind of device to get online. You can remove websites. You can delete people's accounts from social media sites like Facebook or Twitter. But that doesn't mean they can't get back on in some fashion.
You know, you wrote about what Cloudflare did after the violence in Charlottesville recently. The company's CEO decided to kick a major hate site off the internet. What happened with all of that? Tell us about that.
So this site called The Daily Stormer had been around since about 2013, and it was a particularly virulent group. They had a lot of creative messaging for the far right. So they were good at crafting messages for young people. If you're familiar with the idea of memes, a lot of their messaging was promoted and crafted via the use of memes to make it attractive to different people and easily consumed material. And they played quite a pivotal role in messaging around the 2016 election of the value for voting for Trump on the presidential side to enable the far right. And once Trump won, they felt like they'd been emboldened and empowered. And members of that site started using the resources they had in order to develop rallies and recruitment strategies in the real world, which played out in Charlottesville.
So what did the company CEO do? I mean, how did they do it?
Well, Cloudflare is a site that provides anti-DDoS hosting. Basically, it's a mechanism to ensure that your site can't be knocked offline by people trying to engage in different forms of attacks. They offer cybersecurity as a resource for different websites and different kinds of hosting. So by eliminating their services to the Daily Stormer and other companies doing the same thing, suddenly they were no longer able to have their content hosted through major providers. And as a result, they had to start shopping the site around to other places, to other internet service providers, and every other service provider they went to started taking the group down as well. So they became blacklisted, but only because virtually every other internet service provider after Cloudflare said, we're not going to host your content either.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Thomas Holt. He's an associate professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University. He's one of three academics who recently penned a paper on what would and wouldn't work with such a strategy suggested by President Trump earlier this month for cutting off internet access to extremists. That occurred after a bomb exploded in London. If you have a question or comment for Thomas Holt, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. Now, the Cloudflare CEO criticized his own role in all of this. I'm not sure whether it was he was joking or not, but he said he got up in a bad mood that day, and that's when he decided to kick him off, you know, off that site, off their coverage. He said no one should have that power to decide who gets to be online. He said that the move was not a signal of a new company policy, but it could be, right?
Probably not. The challenge for a company like Cloudflare is that they actually support a number of different extremist groups and cyber crime groups because they consider their service to be agnostic. We take whoever pays for our service. So to actively remove one group means they're taking a stance against a certain type of behavior. But in reality, they're still hosting content that violates their own terms of service.
So some scholars predict that shutting down hate speech online could cause a backlash. What's the scenario there?
Well, the problem is that if you start taking down content, particularly for just one group, all that does is send the message that they're being marginalized, that they're being pushed out by the mainstream. And so it can help enable their recruitment strategy because suddenly they're too dangerous for the internet or their ideas are too radical. And to some people, that's only going to beg the question, why did they get removed? What are they talking about? And people will seek out that content and try to figure out what it means for them.
What's the role of the so-called dark web in all of this?
Great question. So the dark web is a portion of the internet hosted on a service called Tor. And it's not a traditional type of service provider. Tor is basically a service that runs on individual computers. So Tor is a resource that some people use for communication or for internet connectivity. The site The Daily Stormer that was kicked off of Cloudflare actually went to Tor for a little while and had their website hosted there. The problem is that Tor isn't exactly the most user-friendly product. So many people who would visit their site may not be familiar with how Tor works or how to use it properly, and so it limited the number of people who would go to it having it hosted on the dark web.
But it is a place for websites like the Daily Stormer to at least go and reconnoiter?
Exactly. In fact, on the dark web, there's everything from child pornography to people selling hard drugs to people selling firearms to credit card data to stuff like the Daily Stormer or radical jihadist content or other types of extremist activity.
Well, why can't somebody shut down the dark web? What kind of power does it have?
Well, the dark web, since it's hosted on individual computers, means that it's not a resource like a traditional internet service provider like Cloudflare. There isn't a single lever that can be pushed in order to delete or remove that content. And the dark web operates via encryption, so it's hard to know where an actual resource is hosted. You can't get the IP address for that location's computers, so it's hard to actually take down.
You wrote that having an online presence appears to help hate groups stay active over time. What's the evidence for that? I mean, you talked about the Daily Stormer, but what about others?
So groups like Stormfront, which was a sort of platform for virtually any group in the far right, whether it's the white nationalists, white supremacists, other ideologically motivated groups, they could come together, talk about whatever they wanted to talk about, find others who shared their perspective. Virtually anything from how to date someone in the far right to what rally to go to this weekend based on your geographic location. So it was one-stop shopping for radical lifestyles, basically. So a resource like that means anyone could connect. And there's been evidence that people who've engaged in acts of violence in the real world were active participants on Stormfront. For instance, Dylan Roof, who shot multiple people in South Carolina in 2015, was an active participant on Stormfront.
You and one of your co-authors were on the team that created the U.S. Extremist Crime Database. That's mm-hmm. an open source database helping scholars better understand the criminal behaviors of jihadi, far right and far left extremists. What went into creating that database?
So that database was created by my colleagues, Steve Shermack and Josh Freelich. Oh, no problem. Yeah. And so their work has been integral in trying to understand what are the types of behaviors that extremists engage in. It's not just bombings or the sort of headline-making news, but what other incidents do people perform? Are there acts of domestic violence? Are there traditional forms of crime that radical groups engage in or that extremists commit? And what does that tell us about the behavior patterns of extremists generally?
So what have you learned?
Well, one of the key findings from the ECDB research is that websites have been a pivotal resource in group longevity. So for the range of far-right groups that are out there, those who have a web presence, whether that's a page or some other type of online content, have a greater overall lifespan than those that don't.
I would imagine, I was thinking about this earlier when we were talking about the dark web too. Do people who track them, has the internet made it easier, even has it helped them stay active over a longer period of time? Does it also help people who are trying to understand what they're up to?
A little bit, yes, because you have the ability to see what they're talking about in real time, and it gives you a sense of individual perspective, which is often hard to do unless you're hearing someone say what's on their mind. So it gives a potential unfiltered view on individual activity. The problem is that there are so many different platforms that groups can use, and individuals can have different names or different online identities that make it hard to correlate one person across multiple sites. So you may never know if this individual poster on one site is actually the same person on a different site, or even on the same site, just using a different handle or username.
How do the groups know who's doing it?
Well, the groups are varied, and so there's not like a specific role for members. There are a few that have something like that, sort of a written hierarchy or structure, but some of them do not. And the way that they know who's involved and who isn't is based on their individual posting habits. So a person with a username that's been online for 10 years may be considered more trustworthy than someone who's just created an account yesterday. So there are some small ways that people can validate individual identity. A lot of the public-facing stuff that you could find that a regular researcher could identify on a web forum, though, may be different from the interpersonal communications that are hidden. So whether it's direct emails from person to person or texts or other types of private messaging, that's a good way for members who are very deeply entrenched to really know the identity or at least the behavior of another person.
The database, the U.S. Extremist Crime Database, looks at the behaviors of jihadi, far-right, and far-left extremists. Are there any common denominators in how they do their business?
There are a few. Having an online presence is certainly somewhat consistent, but the behaviors themselves can be varied. So thinking about the far-left, we often associate that with animal rights groups, earth rights groups, and so they're less actively engaged in targeting huge targets like, say, a jihadist group would. So committing a 9/11 style event is not necessarily in the view of a far-left extremist because they're more focused on, say, animal rights or taking down companies or groups that are basically harming animals.
Mm-hmm. And the jihadi?
And jihadists are primarily interested in severe acts of violence that will generate attention to the cause. So there is some commonality between a jihadist group and, say, a far-right group. The primary difference, though, is that it seems as though far-right groups are going to more often engage in individual offenses, so shootings, small-scale bombings, versus what a jihadist group may attempt to do with, say, like the underwear bomber from 2010 who was attempting to attack an entire plane.
Is there a tonal difference to the different, from the different points of view when it comes to what they put on the internet? When I've talked with people about jihadists and how they're using the internet to recruit and that sort of thing, there's a sense of romanticism about it that appeals to the people that they're trying to engage. Is there anything like that that's useful to know?
A little bit, yes. So with the jihadist groups, there is a focus on crafting messages that are going to be attractive that often incorporates language from government or from different organizations that are viewed as specifically demonstrating a government position. So incorporating comments from Trump at rallies that are anti-Muslim speaks to their specific messaging campaigns by saying the government is truly going after Islam as a faith. Mm-hmm. Whereas for the far right, that's a little less valuable. They're instead focused around trying to target people and their perspectives on either race or xenophobic concepts, because that's the underlying message that they have, is this focus on keeping the white race either in power or alive through different means.
Thomas Holt, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thomas Holt is an associate professor of criminal justice at Michigan State. He is one of three academics who recently penned a paper on what would and wouldn't work with such a strategy as President Trump has called for earlier this month in cutting off internet access to extremists after a bomb exploded in London. You can check out the link to read that report on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Maybe you've heard reference to the so-called gaydar some among us believe they possess. That is the ability to identify someone as lesbian or gay without knowing him or her. Maybe you're among those who thought they had gaydar only to learn maybe not so much. A pair of Stanford University researchers a few weeks ago announced that they might have cracked the code with artificial intelligence. James Vincent wrote about the announcement for The Verge. He joins us by phone from London. Welcome to the show.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
So what did the Stanford University researchers claim they had achieved?
So they claimed that they'd use a technology called deep learning to analyze a big database of faces of self-identified gay and straight men and women, and that they could tell with some reliability in specific tests whether someone was gay or straight just by looking at their photograph. But these findings were overblown by many places in the press and have come in for criticism, both from sociologists and from people who work in the AI community.
What images did they use to pursue this deep learning?
So they had a big database taken from a dating website. We're not sure which dating website they used, but they had sort of, I think, in the order of tens of thousands of images, often multiple images from the same individual. And they used that to train this artificial intelligence system, which uses facial recognition. But the fact that the images came from a dating website was a big problem for a lot of people because they pointed out that it made what the system was looking at a biased data set in that, you know, you think you might be picking up on some sort of, well, the researchers claimed they were picking up on some sort of structural differences in the faces. But people pointed out that they might just have been picking up on, you know, cultured social cues about how people present themselves for a dating site.
You know, it reminded me of that case of, I don't know if it was a year or so ago, when there was an app that you could kind of beautify yourself, and it turned out it was making everybody whiter looking.
Yeah, well, it's a really similar case in some ways, because it's about how we have biases in these AI systems that come from the data that they are trained on. And in the case of that app, which, yeah, was a very well-known one, I think it was made by a Russian company, yeah, all the faces they trained it on were white. So when it was looking at the faces of non-white people, it just made them whiter. And, you know, that's something that conforms to larger problems about kind of what are the beauty standards around the world and how do they reflect sort of inequalities within society.
Which suggests that no matter what kind of AI you have, as long as you're feeding it culturally biased images, that's going to come out culturally biased.
Yeah, exactly. And so this was a big criticism of this study. Mm-hmm. Now, the defenders of the study and the main professor who did it, Mikhail Kaczynski from Stanford, you know, his argument was that he wanted to just prove it could be done in order to raise alarm bells. You know, he says to people that the danger is not necessarily that these things are accurate, but that they exist and that some people will use them. And that could be, for example, an authoritarian regime somewhere like Russia, where, you know, the approach to, you know, sexual minorities is much less than friendly.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chechnya, they want to build, yeah.
Oh yeah, Chechnya example is a horrible example of how far that can go. Yeah.
Was there any control in this experiment?
A control in what sense?
In sense that there was a program that was fed something differently. I mean, did they, or was it just all one the same group of images, and that's all they looked at.
So they did compare it to a second group of images that they took from Facebook, but it was a really limited comparison. It didn't go through the same tests as the one that produced the headline accuracy figures about, you know, oh, we can identify 81%. And the Facebook pictures themselves, people pointed out that they might have been biased because the way they used them or the way they gathered them was they looked for people who had liked Facebook pages like Gay and Fabulous and I Love Being Gay. And you could argue as well that the people who like those pages on Facebook, you know, are likely to represent only a subset of the gay population themselves.
Right. How are different? I mean, talk about the fears about something like this, even though it's not it exists now, right?
Yeah, I mean, so it does exist. The tools are all there. Anyone could put this together. And researchers in the AI community have said, you know, just because these guys are the first lot to publish on it, you can bet that people have made these sorts of things, you know, in their spare time. They're sort of that easy to put together. But they're not going to publish on them because it's, you know, it's a very controversial subject. And in that way, Kaczynski and his co-author Yulan Wang have done a good service in terms of bringing this into a public debate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see the problem with these things as not necessarily about their accuracy, because, you know, it's very debatable. And the underlying theory that was put forward in the paper, which is to do with the influence of hormones on fetuses in the womb and how that affects or is one factor in affecting sexuality, you know, whether or not you believe that or not, if people think these things work, these tools work, then they will be used to persecute people in the same way that, I mean, there have been links drawn between this paper and the pseudoscience of physiognomy, which was obviously a big deal, as it were, in the 19th century. And
the shape of your nose, your thickness of your eyebrows, whatever it might be.
Exactly, exactly. And the critics say just because you have the appearance of scientific objectivity and neutrality does not mean that, you know, the ends to which these tools will be put is objective or is neutral. And often is the case, you know, researchers have warned a lot about AI absorbing the biases and the prejudices of society through the data that they are being fed. And so unless you're very careful, you end up having these super powerful tools that just reflect the worst parts of society.
What is it that a computer is doing and artificial intelligence is doing that humans can't do? I mean, I guess what the control is there any indication that these artificial intelligences that they're better at this, all things being equal, than humans are?
Yeah, they're definitely better at spotting patterns than we are. And I would just say, I'm guilty of this myself as well, but I think, you know, artificial intelligence is the sort of broad field of research. And when we refer to these systems, which are at the end of the day just software programs that someone has, you know, has made on their computer, I think if we call them AI, it's as if we're giving them agency of their own right and as if they're not ultimately the product and the tool of human minds.
Right.
I think it's good to be clear on the fact that these are just things that people have created. They're not running amok. They're not, you know, doing things without being commanded to. But sorry, sidetrack to go back to you.
No, I think that's a good point to bring up. But the fear ultimately is they could be.
Yeah, I mean, they could be further down the road.
Right.
And I think when that happens, won't be because AI has become conscious. AI has become a sort of an entity with its own desires. Mm-hmm. In the world, it'll just be because the system is so complex that we can't work out exactly what it's doing. And in that way, it's like the fear of any sort of bureaucratical or sufficiently complex digital system. And in the case of this one, you know, the complexity comes from the fact that we don't really know why the AI made the decisions it did. Now, the creators say they have a theory. Other people say it's not right. But we don't know.
Well, what is their theory?
So their theory is what I mentioned earlier about this prenatal hormone theory, which, so it's about the influence of hormones in the womb. And their hypothesis is that because we know that those hormones affect sexuality to a degree, and they're definitely not the only factor, and they will affect face shape as well. And they think, therefore, you could draw links between face shape and sexuality.
Yeah, well, that's their theory about why any of us make assumptions about what somebody looks like. But is that what the AI is doing?
But the thing is, we don't know exactly what the AI is doing.
Right.
They think that's what the evidence it's drawing on. Other people say, well, it could be drawing on, you know, just how people presented themselves within this data set.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting. Was this just images that they were given or more information?
No, just images.
Then how do they draw conclusions about anything else but the image? What else could it be?
Well, it could be, for example, so I'll give another clearer example.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, a group of Chinese researchers, they said they had come up with a facial recognition system that could identify criminals. They had done a sort of similar in terms of structure test, and that they had a data set, lots of pictures of individuals. Some of them were labeled as criminals. Some of them were labeled as non-criminals. They'd fed this into a system. The system had picked up on patterns within that data set. And then when they tested it, they claimed it could tell whether someone was a criminal or not just by looking at their photograph. Now, when kind of this got the research community, AI research community got wind of this, they started, you know, analyzing it. What's really going on here? Surely you can't tell whether someone is criminal just by looking at their face. One of the theories they came up with, I'm not sure if it was ever proved because they never released a full data set, but one of the theories was that when you looked at some of the pictures that these researchers had been using, all the pictures of criminals were showing them in non-smart clothing, whereas all the pictures of the non-criminals were showing them wearing a suit and a shirt and a tie. So the theory is that all the facial recognition system was actually doing was picking up on what people were wearing and just making a guess from that about whether someone was a criminal or not. So there's nothing innate in what the picture was. It was just about the context of the picture.
And
the theory is the same thing's happened here.
And that's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, what somebody's wearing, they could start to see patterns and that sort of a thing. You know, when you talk about China, there doesn't seem to be any country more interested in using artificial intelligence and using technology to kind of corral people. They're already doing it in China with certain programs, liking people when you see them, scanning people with facial recognition of one type or another. I mean, there is a Black Mirror kind of a aspect to all of this, whether it's accurate or not.
Yeah, exactly. And if people believe it works as a way of sorting out, you know, who has what characteristics, then they will use it in that way to enforce some sort of order. And you're definitely right. In China, there seems to be a more permissive attitude towards this sort of technology, and people are less squeamish about it than they are, say, in the West, in the US, and in the UK. So facial recognition software is much more widely deployed and, you know, used for trivial things such as allotting toilet paper in public bathrooms. And, you know, these sorts of things feed into larger systems where people just become accustomed to it. And I think that's why it's incredibly important when you have a controversial paper like this AI Gaydar one, that we interrogate exactly what its claims are and what it has achieved. Otherwise, there's this possibility that it snowballs. And that's when things get out of control, not because the AI has become sentient, but because we have forgotten to get a grip on what we can actually achieve here.
Well, James Vincent, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me.
James Vincent is a reporter for The Verge. We will have a link to his article about the Stanford University research that came out a few weeks ago announcing that they might have cracked some kind of code with artificial intelligence. It's very questionable. Read it for yourself. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Fast and Furious fans and those who recall their childhood toy race tracks with fondness unite, literally, in a new iteration of the Anki Overdrive Fame Kit. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor for Android Central, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Did I pronounce everything okay?
Yeah, I think it's Anki instead of Anki, okay. but I honestly don't know.
Okay. So first tell us about Anki Overdrive and the kit. I mean, what is it? What does it do?
Yeah, so, you know, you walk up to this thing and it's, you know, there's this racetrack on a table and it looks like the toy racetracks that have been around for, you know, goodness only knows how long, you know, where you got the little controller in your hand and you race the little cars around on the track and, mm-hmm. and you race your friends and whoever gets to the end wins. But that was the point. It was designed to look, you know, kind of deceptively simple. And underneath of all of that is this like a traditional video game that you would normally play on a television where the cars that are on the track are actually powered by an artificial intelligence. And they're actually doing most of the racing, these little cars. Whereas you holding the controller are actually doing more of this gameplay thing where you're controlling virtual weapons that are on the system and figuring out, you know, what special move you're going to do as you go around this next turn. And so it took this, this you know, really simple looking racing game and turned it into something that feels like a complete video game that you would play on a television. It was really fascinating that Anki released a couple years ago now. And it's something that has been, you know, pretty popular. But when you walk into a store and you look down at this thing, it's a little hard to explain that this toy racetrack looking thing actually costs close to $180.
Well, okay, what are you looking at when you're racing the cars? There are little cars that race around the track, right?
These little cars that race around on your track, and you're holding a phone in your hand that has like three or four very simple buttons on it. So that you can choose what lane you're going to be in and choose, you know, what maneuver you're going to make as you go around the car on the track. And you're doing very little of the actual racing. But when your car, so you're looking down at the track at these cars, these actual physical cars. Uh-huh. And when the car comes, you know, around a corner and is now, you know, positioned behind another car, you push a button on the phone that fires, you know, this special electromagnetic pulse or you know, whatever it would be, that whatever special weapon your vehicle has. And the car... the actual physical car that's in front of you will stop. You know, it'll be disabled for a couple of seconds. And so the person driving that car, you know, will lose control of that vehicle for a few seconds. And so it alters the race, you know, in a way that would be impossible to alter, you know, in you know, the traditional way that you would be racing these kind of toy cars.
You say it's about as different from a model car racing experience that is you can have while still managing to look exactly like one, and you're really messing with my head. Okay, I'm just trying.
It's such a bizarre thing to try and explain, you know. And when I sit people down and play it, you know, it becomes a lot more interesting to really kind of show and see as people absorb this idea. And what made it all the more fascinating with this most recent version is that it's that entire racing experience that has been tied into the Fast and the Furious universe, all of the movies from the Fast and the Furious,
right.
Fast and the Furious universe. So now not only are you racing these cars, but you're actually racing some of the iconic cars from these movies with you know, soundtracks and things, you know, from these movies are the you know, it brings kind of that additional element of, I guess, not technically realism, but immersion.
Well, and it cracked me up, though, because I was like, okay, well, how did they do that? Is that very good? Did they do a good job at that? And you're like, and by the way, I've never seen a Fast and Furious movie.
I've never seen a Fast and Furious movie, and I felt awful.
I haven't either. You know, either.
You know, the people from Anki, they're like, we really hope you like this thing. And I was like, cool, so this is going to sound like a really bad question. Do I need to watch the movies before I play uh-huh. with your toy cars? You know, am I going to? And, you know, so I still have not gone and watched them, but I have a sister who is now... you know, read the review and demanded that I go and sit with her and watch these movies now. So I'm sure that before the year is over, I will have consumed at least a couple of these movies. But, you know, what I did get from this is that, you know, the main character, Dom, from the first movie, his car, the very iconic-looking muscle car from the first movie, is one of the cars that's in the box. And so you open the box and you've got this car and you're racing against, you know, the other people from these movies. And with that, you know, just comes its own separate story that's not technically a part of the Fast and Furious universe. But you're going through. You can just, you know, choose to race with your friends, or there's this set of missions, you know, like a story that you're racing through, where you have to, you know, outrun police cars, and you have to, you know, take, you know, run one of your friends off the road because he's betrayed you, and you know, this kind of deep story that becomes a part of this world. That you can choose to play on your own, and your phone then becomes, you know, both the artificial intelligence for your car, and then the other cars that are on become remotely piloted, you know, through your phone being connected to this entire setup, with this just kind of really advanced game feel.
You describe it as more than a racing system. You call it a full combat experience. What do you mean by that? And is it suitable for children?
It is suitable for children because there's no projectiles, and there's no, like, you know, sounds of guns being fired or anything like that. There's no, you know, nothing overly violent. But there is a combat element to it. You know, there's this like I said earlier, there's this electromagnetic pulse thing, and there's a tether that you can fire, and it's all virtual. There's nothing physical that you can see, but the mm-hmm. front of my car lights up. And the back of this other car lights up, and all of a sudden the car that was in front of me can't accelerate anymore because virtually it is tied to my car for you know, half a lap or whatever, or you know, I can you know, hack the engine, you know, the computer in the engine of the car next to me, and so I've you know, slowed them down for the next half a lap while they figure out what's going on, and it becomes a very combative experience where you have to really think about where you're positioned on the racetrack as you're going around the turn. If someone comes up behind you very quickly, you have to make sure that you're getting out of their way so that they can't use those weapons on you. And it becomes a great deal more interactive than just racing, which was already in and of itself a pretty fun and challenging experience.
You mentioned that you can pack it up and bring it over to a how big is the track? What is it? How big is it? Just tell me.
So the track that comes in the starter kit takes up about a quarter of my office, which is, you know, 4 meters by 5 meters. And, you know, you can arrange this kind of however you want. And each one of the pieces, you know, you're talking about probably, you know, 2.5 to 3 feet pieces that are all magnetically attached. So like any other, you know, racing kit, you can mm-hmm. assemble the track however you want. And the cars run around on the track and kind of create a map for the artificial intelligence to figure out once you've done that. And you can change the map, you know, 100 times to whatever configuration you want. And Anki sells, you know, extra, you know, track pieces. So you can make these tracks as long as you want.
So do I envision a Anki track room in your future someday?
It's seriously possible because my kids are hooked on this and I really enjoy it. And, you know, I like playing these kind of games when I have friends over or when I have family over. Uh-huh. So it may not be something that is permanently up, but it is definitely something that I'm going to make sure that I have room for so that, you know, when, you know, my cousins come over for a family event or something, that it's there for everyone to enjoy.
I guess it's like Father of the Year award time again.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I keep bouncing back and forth on that one.
Exactly. As you improve with this game, so do your artificial intelligence opponents in this game. Is that typical for games like this?
It is typical for a lot of, you know, typical video games, but it wasn't something that I expected from this, really, because it's hard to kind of think about it like a video game. But as you have an account in the game, and as you play, your car and the other cars that are being raced, they have a level token, like in a video game. And so the more you race and do things, the more it levels up and the more money you have in the game to spend on other things. So you can, you know, virtually buy new tires that have better grip, or, you know, a faster engine or something like that. But as you're playing, the people that you're racing against are doing the same thing. So those cars are also leveling up and gaining new weapons and better engine parts. And so, yes, the game is increasingly challenging, you know, even once you figured out kind of the basics of the game system. You know, the artificial intelligence is working hard to improve itself to continue to be able to be a challenge for you.
The starter kit costs about $170. It's worth it, I take it.
I definitely, you know, if the idea of a toy racing track that does more is something that, that appeals to you, if you think it's something that your kid is or interested in, this is absolutely worth it. You know, it's very simple to set up and break down. It's very easy to keep clean, and it's really a lot of fun. And it wasn't something that it genuinely surprised me when I sat down and played with this thing.
Is this going to be on your Christmas list when we go over Christmas gift priorities this year?
Yeah, it'll definitely be a part of my Christmas list for this year.
All right. Google. The headline on this story in Android Central was Google wants to win the smartphone game, and with its purchase of ATC, this might be possible. I already call whatever phone I'm using my Googler. Isn't that enough for Google? They want more?
Well, so that's the big thing with Android is that, you know, Google is, a big part of the software experience. But as you take a look at Apple, you know, Apple has a tremendous software experience and they own the entirety of the hardware. So Apple makes a tremendous amount of money each year from the hardware that is sold that works with all of these softwares and services. And, you know, that's what Google wants to do next is they want to own a part of that hardware experience so that they're making money off of the hardware as well as the software. And we've seen that over the last couple of years with the Google Pixel phones and the Google Nexus phones. And this last year, you know, the Google phones were a part of a relationship with HTC. HTC has been making phones with Google running Android for a really long time. And so now Google has they've invested a tremendous amount of money into HTC. And in exchange for that, a lot of the hardware team responsible for the Pixel phones are coming over to actually become Google employees working full-time only on these Google products instead of, you know, being HTC employees working on multiple products.
Yeah, it's about 2,000 people, right?
It's about 2,000 people, and it's the cash infusion that HTC is getting from Google to you know, advance these other projects is really significant because HTC as a company has pretty steadily declined as far as as far as revenue goes over the last couple of years because it's been very complicated to compete with Samsung and LG and these other companies as smartphones become, you know, more and more about who has the best camera and which one has the longest battery life instead of, you know, which one has, you know, these unique features.
Android Central editor Daniel Bader wrote about this, and he said that there were pro and con opinions when Google bought HTC. And now he says there's a more nuanced understanding of the deal, and that was that they were buying something that wasn't obvious, and that was the employees and the designers and that kind of a thing. It sounds like a larger payroll, and I'm just wondering, people can always just leave, right, and go somewhere else? It's not like infrastructure or software.
People can always just leave, and it's, you know, this is definitely not a, you know, a set in stone positive or negative, but it's important to understand, you know, from a corporate perspective, HTC has this remarkable history of design language. It's a weird thing to think about from people who aren't, you know, who just walk into a store and buy a phone, mm-hmm. but HTC regularly wins awards for the quality of their design, the materials they use to make sure that the phones, you know, can survive a fall. And things like that, you know, from these are industry awards that this company has been winning for a long time. Mm. And it's something that very few other companies have been able to claim, you know, a history of being able to design hardware that well so that it's, you know, it lasts a long time and works well. And that's the biggest reason that Google wants this team is to be able to bring that level of quality to these phones moving forward.
The article said that the HTC deal won't bear fruit until 2023, and that's not really – it's not that long away anymore. I mean, it's only 6 years away, but in digital native terms, in your terms, that's forever.
It is forever, and it's you know, this is something that a lot of people when it comes to, you know, phones, people who are, you know, digital natives who are always eager to buy, you know, whatever the next shiniest thing is, mm-hmm. it's a constant kind of conversation, is that, you know, Apple just released the iPhone 8 and are about to release the iPhone 10. You know, the iPhone 11 has already been designed. You know, the Apple's now working on the details around that design. There's not going to be any radical changes onto that phone. Apple already has a really good idea of what that phone's going to look like and how much it's going to cost and what's going to be in it. for the phone that they're going to release next year. And it's difficult for a lot of digital natives to put that into context. You know, what Apple's going to be working on designing is the thing that we're going to see in 2 years, 3 years. And so we're seeing a lot of that same thing here with this deal with HTC, is that HTC is going to come in and help Google kind of start over from scratch when it comes to designing hardware. And that's just something that takes, from, let's say, my perspective, a long time. It's not something we're going to see in the next year.
Well, that's why I kind of wondered, is there something else they might have up their sleeve that was secret?
It's definitely possible. You know, Google and HTC work together on a lot of projects, you know, mm-hmm. virtual reality headsets that they've worked together on, you know, and so it's definitely something that we will start to see some things from HTC that are benefiting Google, over the immediate future. But as for, you know, the huge kind of forward thinking plan for Google is definitely one that is well into 2020.
All right. So Xbox One, there's an Xbox One Enhanced, and Microsoft is talking about that. What's the connection there?
Well, so the big thing with, you know, the Xbox One X ends up being kind of confusing for people because it's not really all that different from the Xbox One that we've had for a little while for people who don't have a 4K television. This is an Xbox One for people who want that 4K television experience. And so Microsoft is trying to help explain what the differences are going to be between the Xbox One that you own now and the Xbox One X that will be available later this year. And the big part of that from a gaming perspective is what they're calling the enhanced titles. And these are games that already exist, like Rise of the Tomb Raider and Forza Motorsport, that are the same exact game that you already own, but when you play them on an Xbox One X, they are going to be visually improved. The graphics are going to be a little better. It's going to run a little faster. There will be new challenges that are only available to people who own, that version of the console.
And it won't cost more?
There are very few cases where it's going to cost more. There are a lot of developers who have said upright, you know, we're going to support the Xbox One X Enhanced. There's more than 130 games that are going to be supported when the Xbox One X comes out. But there are some developers who have decided that, you know, the upgrade to Enhanced is something that they're going to charge, you know, an extra $5 or $10 to download those improvements for.
Oh, okay. Per game.
Right, it would be per game, and it's a handful. I think only 5 developer teams have confirmed that that's the way that they want to go right now. So that you're looking at 5 or 6 games out of the 130 that have already committed, where if you want that enhanced mode, there will be an option to pay for it. For the others, it'll end up being just a free upgrade. If you own the Xbox One X, you'll automatically have these enhanced features.
Okay, and the launch is November 7th of this new console. How much does it cost?
It starts at...
It always scares me when you say that.
It starts at $499, and there are going to be plans for bundles that are going to make it more expensive with other color variants and other storage variants, something that Microsoft is going to be working on, you know, through the holiday season. The biggest thing for Microsoft is having this kind of beginning version that is available so that it is the thing for people to buy when the holiday season hits.
And your predictions?
I still think that there are not a whole lot of people, you know, in the grand scheme of things that own 4K televisions, you know, and that's the big thing here is that this is great for 4K gaming. So for someone like me, you know, who is kind of an avid tech junkie, I still don't see the benefit in buying a 4K television yet. It's not something, most of my content is still not in 4K.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this is nice if you don't have an Xbox and you wanted to upgrade, it's not going to be like the absolute must-have thing if you already own an Xbox.
When is that 4K revolution going to come?
That's an awesome question. And maybe someday next year we'll get an answer. But this year we're definitely not getting one.
All right. Russell Holly, thanks as always for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
It's Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday. Thank you so much for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.